Good morning, all, and welcome to the March 19th meeting of the House Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. We do have a quorum, and our first order of business is the approval of the minutes from the meeting of yesterday, which was March 18th. And I believe those are with us in our packet here as well. The reason I hesitate is, there we go. We've got it. We are in good shape here. Representative Faulkner, have you had a chance to review the minutes from the meeting of March 18th?
Oh, my gosh. Let me look.
They look pretty great to me. I move that they be adopted.
All right. Representative Faulkner moves the minutes for March 18th. Any corrections, deletions, additions? Hearing none and seeing none, all those in favor of the motion to approve the minutes of March 19th signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. The first two bills that we have on the agenda today are bills that I will be carrying. And as I make my way to the testifying table, I'm going to invite Representative Allen to come forward, and he will be chairing those two bills. And the destination for these two bills is to lay over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill that the committee may be considering. So as I make my way, Representative Allen.
Representative Driscoll, would you like to move HF 1546 before the committee with the intent to lay over?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is my intention to move House File 1546 before the committee this morning to lay over for possible inclusion in a future finance and policy omnibus bill to be considered by the committee.
To your bill.
Thank you. In the state of Minnesota, we take fire safety very, very seriously, and over the years and over the centuries, we have adopted statute and later have moved to the fire code here in the state of Minnesota, which is adopted and enforced across the state. As we continue to evolve in fire service and as we continue to evolve in public safety, certain laws have become, in the statute, have become mute in the fact that they no longer apply because of maybe things like materials that are no longer used, methods that are of construction that aren't permitted, other types of activities that may just change the way we do things, making our homes and our existence safer as it relates to fire code. So House File 1546 simply goes through and repeals some of the statutes that are on the books that are really, again, rather moot. They just don't really do anything anymore. And in some cases, there's conflict between current state fire code and traditional statutory language that dates back to the early 1900s. And with me today is the state fire marshal, and he will testify to the changes and the repeals that we're looking at. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rep. O'Driscoll, to your testifier.
Go ahead and identify yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm State Fire Marshal Dan Cryer, and I appreciate Representative O'Driscoll authoring this bill. This is a technical cleanup, right? As the representative beautifully stated, we're looking to give clarity as to fire safety in Minnesota to send people to the state fire code versus looking at a variety of different statutes. And we want to avoid conflict in what fire safety looks like in Minnesota. And so removal of these outdated statutes, statutes that no longer apply, is a cleanup effort, and it won't lead to any less safety in Minnesota because we follow more stringent practices today with the adoption of the state fire code.
All right. Thank you for that. To you, Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, I don't have any other testifiers. I don't know if there's anyone from the public here today who would like to comment on the matter before the committee, but you may want to check.
Yeah. Yeah, is there anybody that would like to comment, any public comment? Then we'll proceed to member questions. Wow, you're going to make this easy, aren't you? All right, with that, we'll close the bill. We're going to lay over. So we're going to lay over HF 1546 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
All right, Rep. O'Driscoll, would you like to move HF 2403 before the committee with the intent to lay over?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do move House File 2403 before the committee with the intention of laying it over for possible inclusion in a future policy and finance bill being contemplated by the committee. This is the first of three bills that we'll hear that have come from the Minnesota Department of Commerce, who this committee has legislative jurisdiction, governance. And the bill that we have before us, there are a couple of things I want to just highlight. It is the Department of Commerce Health Insurance Policy Bill. In sections 1 and 2, we do make some changes to the Medicare Supplement Law passed a few years ago. I'm glad that we're able to make these changes. There has been some conflict and some issue, and this change that's proposed in House File 2403 will resolve those conflicts and those language issues. I also have a couple of other proposals, and I do believe Representative Elkins also has a proposal that's out there, House File 2335, that addresses this issue. Sections 3 through 5 of the Health Insurance Policy Bill changes the guaranteed renewability provisions. I think this language is a little subjective, and I'm looking forward to working with the plans and the commissioner's office to clarify the language on this and on these matters. And our testifier today will have more to say about that from the Department of Commerce. And finally, sections 6 through 8 of the bill add some cross references and some technical change coverage for cancellation of policies and coverage, as well as cancellation of non-renewable policies and replacement of coverage. Mr. Chair, with that, we have Sam Smith with us, who is the Government Affairs Director from the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and he will further detail the provisions that we talked about just moments ago in House File 2303. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, could you please state your name and proceed?
Co-chairs O'Driscoll and Herr, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sam Smith, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the Department of Commerce and our health insurance policy bill. This bill makes changes to the Medicare supplement market and more closely aligns Minnesota law on guaranteed renewability with federal standards. To begin with the MedSup market, Commerce's proposal modifies legislation passed in 2023 to allow insurance companies to implement a 10% penalty on Minnesotans who enroll in a Medicare supplement plan outside of their initial enrollment period. Minnesotans eligible for Medicare have two choices when they first enroll. They can either enroll in a Medicare Advantage plan, also called Medicare Part C, or they can buy a Medicare supplement plan, also called Medigap, to help pay for services not covered under original Medicare. They cannot enroll in both at the same time. Currently, if someone is enrolled in a Medicare Advantage plan and wants to switch to a Medicare supplement plan, they may be denied coverage or charged more for their plan based on their health history. In 2023, the Minnesota legislature changed this rule to allow Minnesotans to change from a Medicare Advantage plan to a Medicare supplement plan during an annual open enrollment period and not be penalized because of their health status. This change is going in effect in 2026. Commerce appreciates the intent of this change, recognizing that many people aren't fully aware of their options when they first enroll in Medicare. However, we have concerns that these changes will increase premiums, making the products appealing only to those who are sick and have significant health needs. This could cause insurers to leave the market, leaving Minnesotans with fewer and more expensive options. To better understand these changes, Commerce contracted with an actuarial firm to estimate the impact of the law change. The actuarial company, Risk and Regulatory Consulting, estimated that Medicare supplement plans would see initially see an increase of 6%, in addition to any regular rate increases the first year, and an estimated 16% increase over current rate increases by 2030. To mitigate this impact, Commerce is proposing a 10% penalty to those who enroll in a Medicare supplement plan outside of their initial enrollment period. This preserves the ability for Minnesotans to still have access to Medicare supplement plans regardless of their health status, while still maintaining more stability in the market and lower rate increases. And then to the guaranteed renewability portion of this bill, this proposed change brings Minnesota into alignment with federal laws and allows insurance companies to discontinue offering certain health plans, individual health plans. Under current law, carriers can only discontinue offering plans if they leave the market. The result is insurers are left maintaining plans with low enrollment. This discourages innovation in the market and increases administrative costs and the complexity for health plans. The change still provides protections for Minnesotans, including offering individuals in the discontinued plan options to purchase a different plan. The Commissioner of Commerce may also disapprove an insurance decision to discontinue a plan. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Right, we do have a thank you for your testimony, Mr. Smith. With that, we will take any comment from the public. Is there anybody that wants to testify? Please proceed to the mic and state your name for the record.
Good morning.
And good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, my name is Rich Neumeister. For those people who are new to the legislature, I've been up here for a half a century and I lobby on open government and privacy. I am out of my mainstream here a little bit because I generally don't lobby for things that personally affect me. And I do all this for free, but this does. In 2023, when the Medicare supplement bill was passed to allow complete open enrollment, I listened a little bit, but then I realized because I'm 7 decades old, I'm going to be paying more possibly with the new setup that's here that only several states have done. So I worked with policymakers and the Department of Commerce, who also knew there was no study done. It was just passed. And so they did the study in 2023. It then came here late in April of last year. I worked with policymakers and the former chair, Stevenson, and Chair Klein extended it. That's why it's going to take effect 2026. So it would give time for you as policymakers to deal with it. I met with Julie Dreyer, who's the head of one of the insurance executive divisions there, and I shared, what is the Department of Commerce going to do? The representative from Commerce said 6%. Yes, that's correct. But if you read the report, which is almost a 34-page report, it says it could be as high as 8%. So when they say 13%, it could be high as 20%. Mr. Chairman, Idaho recently just went this way, and they were of increases in a letter that I sent to the Department of Commerce last year, 11 to 20%. So the overall dynamic here is, what will the legislature do to make sure that the skyrocketing premiums that are expected, when you look across the country and even within the report, how will it, you know, will not current users of Medigap out of the ability to afford their plans? So what are the solutions? There were four solutions that were offered in that report. I don't know if those have been addressed here, but there are some. But the bottom line here is that there will be some increases. There are almost, I think, 200,000 people now have Medigap plans. A lot of those folks are of limited income. And my heart goes out to those people that need Medigap, but should be able to get Medigap. So I'm asking you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, to be the wise folks that all of us expect you to be, is try and work and solve this issue so that there can be a win-win for people of limited income like me that are not kicked off and had a 10% increase last year, just in general Medicaid supplement. And for those people who are, you know, who can't get Medigap because of the rules. There are some options out there, and I hope put the smart hats on and be astute and let's solve this issue. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, at any time I'm willing to discuss the kind of detail that I do on privacy and open government. I've done the same thing on this issue. That means I know something. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Neumeister. We will proceed. Is there anybody, anyone else from the public that would like to testify before the committee today?
Yes, please.
And if you could please state your name and for the record and proceed.
Co-chairs and members, I'm Dana Bacon with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. I just wanted to come up and say that I was one of the people who testified in favor of the law that's being addressed here today, and just wanted to let you know that for blood cancer patients, just as Mr. Smith said, I mean, consumers come into the Medicare market making complex decisions, and healthcare and insurance literacy are real concerns. If you're not aware of what you're signing up for or not signing up for, you may make choices that don't fit your healthcare needs later. And unlike in other aspects of the health insurance market, this is one set of products where your pre-existing conditions can be held against you and you may be locked out. We know that with Medicare Advantage, there are concerns about prior authorization, denials, narrow networks. You don't have that with traditional Medicare and with Medigap. For blood cancer patients, the care you need to get your treatment that helps you survive can leave you with considerable out-of-pocket costs if you don't have access to this product. We are highly grateful for the Department of Commerce attempting to address the premium considerations that are in front of them and in front of you. We would encourage your committee to lean toward what the department is doing because it preserves that annual open enrollment. We did submit a letter that says we do have some concerns about the exact nature of the mechanisms, but leaning toward protecting consumer access and leaning away from penalizing people for their pre-existing conditions is what we would encourage you to do. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for your testimony, Mr. Bacon. We will ask for, once again, is there any more public testimony? Seeing none, we will move into member questions. First on deck I have is Rep. Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of kind of simple questions. First of all, the reference study I don't see in our materials for today. Was it posted online or is it otherwise accessible to us? It seems like it's our ability to read that study seems to be really important to what we're doing here right now.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have not received that report and that Representative Elkins is referencing. Representative Elkins, are you talking about the one that Mr. Neumeister talked about?
Rep. Elkins.
The one that Mr. Smith testified about.
Then maybe we should ask the department if they have the report and they can make it publicly available to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, we're happy to make that actuarial report available for members.
Okay, thank you. Second, really quick, clearly this bill rests in the jurisdiction of this committee, but it still feels like it ought to be heard in health as well. That's a question for the chair, for the author.
Yeah, Rep. O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Elkins, there are parts of this, yes, that a case could be made that it's in the health area because it does deal with the Medicare supplements and those markets. Those determinations will need to be made as we continue on with the bill if these provisions are included in the final version of the omnibus bill for policy. We'll kind of address it at that point, but duly noted.
Okay. Rep. Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, comments. So I went through I'm over 65 and a Medicare member, And just a few observations from my journey. As your 65th birthday is approaching, you will be besieged with offers to go through a seminar. Most of them are sponsored by CARES, delivered by independent brokers. I think I went through three of them before I felt like I had gained the full picture and actually settled on the best informed of them to do business with. But people who know me will, of course, realize that I created a spreadsheet to lay out the options and all of the pros and cons, and came to the conclusion that essentially that if you are a reasonably healthy person without any genetic predispositions to having some kind of a serious chronic condition, that the math is always going to point you in the direction of Medicare Advantage. So the plan I'm on this year has a zero premium, $3,900 out-of-pocket maximum, in addition to the basics that any Medicare plan would cover. Mine includes both medical and drugs, dental, hearing, and vision, all within that zero premium over and above the Part B premium that we all have to pay. And just for yucks this year, I went back and looked at, you know, what if I was just turning 65 and had the option still of doing either approach. And the cheapest Medicare supplement plan I could find was $250 a month and did not include dental, vision, hearing. So if you do the math, $250 a month for 12 months is $3,000. And in my worst case scenario, I pay no more than $3,900. So anybody who does the math is going to come to the conclusion that unless you're somebody like Mr. Neumeister, you should probably go with a Medicare Advantage plan and only choose a Medicare supplement plan if you have some reasonable expectation that you're going to eventually be suffering from some chronic disease that is going to cause you to spend more than $3,900 a year on medical care. And so what I am concerned about, and I think this report, when we get to read it, will show as well, is that with the ability, I understood that when I was signing up and signed up for Medicare Advantage, that I was losing the ability to open enroll into a Medigap plan if I got sick and decided to take that risk. But if we allow people to go down the Medicare Advantage plan, which is going to be better for the vast majority of Medicare patients, and then wait until to go into a Medicare supplement plan only once we get sick, we're going to create a terrible adverse selection process. This process is already subject to adverse selection right now. But we're going to end up with the cost of Medicare supplement plans spiraling out of control, which is what Mr. Neumeister is concerned about, and I'm concerned about it as well. So I think this bill is a step in the right direction by putting surcharges on that ability. I'm not sure it goes far enough, and I think that there's a real danger here of us basically ruining the Medicare supplement market in the state.
All right. Thank you, Representative Elkins. We'll get on to the next in the list of questions. Representative Dodseff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, this is more directed toward the commissioner. What is more of the litmus test that you use to determine what's in the best interest of the policyholders?
Mr. Smith.
Chair, Representative Dodseff, thank you for the promotion. I'm the lowly government affairs director. But, this
well deserved.
But it's a great question, and I think when you consider the range of testimony on this issue, including the written testimony from AARP, you can see that this is a complicated issue where any decision that we make is going to create perhaps new problems but also benefit another group of people. And so as we analyze this issue, we considered a range of options and ultimately landed on this solution as a balanced approach that preserves much of what the legislature found appealing about the changes made in 2023 while increasing some protections to avoid the adverse selection challenges that Representative Hokins was managing. But indeed, this is a complicated issue with a lot of moving parts, and so it's challenging.
Representative Dodzeff.
Thank you.
Next in line is Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Representative. My question is maybe directed at the commissioner too. What's the open enrollment period? Is there a window of so many months that people can enroll in this plan? And then the Medicare Advantage versus the Medicare Supplement. I'm just curious, is the supplement, the Medicare Advantage, that's a $0 deductible plan, so there's no deductibles to that. With the regular Medicare Supplement, is that a deductible event that people have?
Mr. Smith.
Chair, Representative Van Binsberg, I may have to phone a friend on the interactions around deductibles with the Medicare supplement market, but generally speaking, they're more expensive and provide more comprehensive coverage.
Representative O'Driscoll.
To the question, Representative Van Binsbergen, it depends upon the kind of supplement that you buy, just like in the private insurance market. You may have a plan that has a copay. You may have a plan that has a certain dollar deductible. And, of course, the more comprehensive the coverage and the more that you ask the plan to pay, the higher the premiums are going to be for that plan. So there's a variety of different programs that are out there. And I can speak to that because I am not Medicare eligible at this point, but I do help manage my mother's affairs, and that's one of the things that we look at annually as well, as Representative Elkins talked about, where should she be and what type of supplement, what type of plan. And there is an open enrollment period that starts in the fall of the year, and that's a federal open enrollment period. It usually ends about the first week of December. To your question about how does that open enrollment period work.
Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So people have got that, it's an annual open enrollment. Every year people can, and I'm assuming they can get in no matter what their health issues are, correct?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair and Representative Van Binsbergen, yes, there is an annual open enrollment, and that's the idea. Make sure you make a good decision for the next 12 months when you're in that open enrollment period, because you're locked in on that, is traditionally how that process works, yes.
Representative Van Binsbergen.
One last question. So our rates in Minnesota, are they, you know, I know the testifier represented Idaho, commented about Idaho's rates. Are our rates pretty competitive around the country?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to answer that in two ways. One is going to be, that's a great question for the department because they actually have more experience on that. But I will put it this way. Rates are going up for Medicare supplements and for all insurance, like we've seen with the issue that's been before this committee on the individual market, right, reinsurance, and the issues. So the premiums are going in one direction. They're going up. And we had a testifier earlier today that said, you know, an 8 or 10% increase was a very sizable increase for that individual and their situation, which I don't dispute, not one for 1 minute. But when we're looking in the individual market with a 40 or 50% increase, a 10% increase would look really, really appealing to those people from the individual market. And again, to the other question, I would be curious to have the department answer that. I'm not the resident expert, but I do have background.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Van Binsberg. First, to your initial question, you know, currently if someone is enrolled on a Medicare Advantage plan and wants to switch to medical supplement, they may be denied coverage or charged more for their plan based on their health history. And so a key change in 2026 was preventing that kind of folks transitioning to the med sup market based upon their health history. And so that is an important policy change. And, you know, I think we all can understand the benefits of that. To your other question about health rates, you know, at the Department of Commerce, we work very hard to ensure that the health rates in the state are fair and competitive and reflect the costs that the health insurance market is experiencing. And due to a number of factors, both primarily outside of our control, the rates are increasing, but we're doing our best.
Mr. Van Binsbergen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the list, I have Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for bringing this forward. I, too, think about the issues related to adverse selection and agree that we need to address that. But I also just need to talk a little bit about the marketing pressure that we see with Medicare Advantage, because I know that insurance companies don't do something for nothing. And so the costs are more hidden. I think we see really, for some carriers, appalling prior authorization and claims denial rates. And I would argue that all of us sitting here are one diagnosis away from having a chronic expensive condition or an emergency. And so this is more maybe to the public than to the committee that when you're thinking about your long-term Medicare decision, as I'll be doing, you must think long-term, you must think about what could happen, what is likely to happen, and are you willing, you know, if you're willing to say, I'll take that 10% bump, you know, and make that calculation. But a lot of the people who are shopping for these products get most of their information, I'm afraid, from confusing websites and TV commercials, may have language barriers, and are not in a position to do the self-education that some of us can do. So I just really wanted to speak on behalf of issues related to the problems with Medicare Advantage, and I just want to end my remark with a quote from an article in November in Modern Healthcare that talks about how some of the major health plans were backing out. They weren't backing out because they couldn't close the products, but they stopped giving commissions to agents and encouraged them not to sell certain Medicare Advantage problems because they were concerned about the cost of those members. So I would just say about Medicare Advantage, buyer beware. Thank you. I'm sorry, there was no question, just support for the bill and a rant. Thank you.
Next is Representative Elkins.
Yeah, just to respond a little bit about that. I think Minnesota might be an outlier, but we have a number of good nonprofit insurers in this market. The market is very competitive. The time I've been on Medicare, I've switched carriers three times because the deals kept getting better. And I will grant that a big part of this, why I have a zero premium plan, is because the federal government does way over subsidize Medicare Advantage. Thank you.
With that, Chair O'Driscoll, any closing comments?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to have the hearing today on the Commerce Committee. Three thoughts that I have. Number one, I started alluding to the fact that cost of insurance is going up everywhere. This committee has spent probably 3 hours of the committee time this year learning about the reinsurance program, testifying on bills, moving those, and we know we have that as a problem. Last year in the Commerce Committee, there was some conversation about really doing some additional changes to the Medicare supplement market, and I suggested at that time in Commerce that we may end up having to have a second reinsurance program out there as a result of some of the changes that were being contemplated here in the state of Minnesota. If you think one is bad, two is worse if you don't like reinsurance programs. The third thing that I will mention is, as I sit before you today, I am the caboose on the baby boomer generation. And the people that have preceded me in this and that large group of people that are moving through, many people are becoming educated very quickly every day on the need, as Representative Ryer indicated and as others have, about choosing the Medicare supplements and how does Medicare work. And you can't really just get by with buying the Medicare Part B and hoping for the best. You do need to have some other kind of safety net for yourself on that. And what I believe is that as more of the people from the baby boomer generation become Medicare eligible, the marketplace will become more informed of what was going on and demand more accountability on that, because there's just going to be a larger number of people who are going to be paying attention to that, because it's themselves, the larger group, their children, who are going to be caring for their parents and looking for that. So I think that we're going to be seeing, in addition to the gray tsunami, I think we're going to see a tsunami of better educated people who are going to say, limited resources, limited dollars, how are we going to be able to do this? My final thought is, although not helping with medical expenses, persons should consider a long-term care policy to take care of other needs during the time of convalescence and other, because of health-related issues and one's inability as we age to do two of the six major features or functions of life. And that is a great way to be able to help make your resources go much further as an aging American. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I ask that we lay House File 2403 over for possible inclusion in a policy bill contemplated by this committee.
Thank you for that. At this moment, the chair lays over HF 2403 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And with that, I will now turn the gavel back over to Chair O'Driscoll.
Good morning, Representative Finke. You are a member of this committee, and so I will ask if you would like to move your bill before the committee. And I believe that we're going to be moving it to the Judiciary Committee based on a few amendments that are being offered, and that will get this bill on its way. Is that your understanding as well?
That is my understanding.
So we'll go ahead and move the bill then.
All right. Hello. Good morning. And that is my move. I move that HF 2389 be referred to Judiciary Committee.
Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. Do you want to do amendments first, or?
Yeah, it's your bill. If you want to get to the form in the shape you like, we're happy to do that. Otherwise,
right,
we can talk about the overview of it. It's your choice. You're the bill author, Representative. Thank you.
I appreciate that. Good morning, committee members. This being my first time presenting in front of the Commerce Committee, I will remind you that my name is Representative Lee Finke, and I use she, her pronouns. I'm happy to be here this morning carrying this agency bill, and we would like to move the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape, and then I believe we have an oral amendment to the amendment that we would also like to move.
All right, well, let's do this. If there's an oral amendment to the A3 amendment, let's take that, incorporate that, and then we'll take the A3 amendment as amended and amend it into the bill. Representative Finke, would you like to highlight where the A3 oral amendment should go? Yes, I'm sorry. Nonpartisan is going to handle that for us?
Yes, please.
Okay. Ms. Pompoul.
Chair and members, the oral amendment will be on the A3 amendment, line 1.4. We're going to delete the word targeted. And by deleting that word, we're adding it back into the statute. And we're going to add a comma at the end of the sentence on line 1.5, so after the word specific.
So, Ms. Pompoul, it should read, if I'm understanding, line 1.4, page 2, comma, line 25, comma, delete, and then strike the language in the quotes for a targeted, and then what did you have from that?
So we're not going to delete all the language in the quotes.
Oh,
we're just going to delete the word targeted within those quotes.
Understood.
Yes,
thank
so
you.
So we're leaving that in the statute.
Yep.
And then I'm just adding a comma for clarity on line 1.5 after the word specific.
Got it. So we'll read page 2, comma, line 25, comma, delete for a... But it doesn't read right. Delete for a and insert. We still have a grammar there or not?
No, Chair. The page and lines are just going to read...
Okay.
Strange.
I just want to make sure that we're not back here fixing it again in the future. Okay. And then all language stays the same from there with a comma at the end of line 1.5. Representative Finke, is that?
That is
acceptable
my very
to you?
Exciting oral amendment.
Okay.
And I would move it.
I don't know that we necessarily need an oral amendment as much as we can just do an incorporation into here. I don't see anybody that's raising an objection. We can incorporate that change or we can take it as an oral amendment, which is the better procedure, Ms. Pompeo.
Chair, I think either is fine. It's a technical change, and we're leaving a word in the statute versus taking a word out. So
just an incorporation, and okay. We'll just incorporate that language, and then Representative Finke, if you want to move the A3 to your House File 2389, and we'll get the bill in the shape you want it.
Yes, so moved, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Finke moves the A3 amendment with the incorporation into House File 2389. Members, discussion to get the bill in the form that the author would like. Seeing none, hearing none, all those in favor of the A3 amendment with the incorporation signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Representative Finke, you are on your way. What have you got this morning for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. HF 2389 is one of the department's bills relating to insurance, and I am going to hand it over to my testifier to explain the bill.
Mr. Brickwitty, welcome to the committee, and if you'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a thank you to Representative Finke for carrying this bill. I'm Peter Brickwitty, Senior Director at the Commerce Department, pinch hitting for Mr. Smith so we can rest his voice a little bit. This is the department's insurance policy bill. There are three components, and I'll go through them for members. So sections 1 through 3 of the bill deal with data calls, and they're a response to some industry feedback that we received this fall while we were working on a research project with the property and casualty insurance companies in the state. And the proposal clarifies how data that's collected from companies by the department for a specific project is classified and provides more precision and clarity for companies on how it would be held and how we could provide summary information to the public and policymakers. And we appreciate the amendment that you just adopted, which we worked on with the industry, just to make sure that there was complete understanding between the department and insurance companies on how the mechanics of that will work. The proposal will help us be faster in our regulatory processes and provide more clarity to the companies on how that data will be held. Section 4 is an NEIC, National Association of Insurance Commissioners, model law dealing with long-term care products. And this is a set of consensus items that we have worked on with the industry. There's no objections to, and it will make it easier for Minnesotans to access long-term care insurance in the state. And then sections 5 through 11 are a proposal from the state's insurer of last resort in the auto industry, the auto plan. This is something that their public policy committee worked on over the past year and a half, and we are carrying in the bill. This proposal would allow APSO, which is the plan operator, to write auto insurance coverage directly on their paper. Currently, APSO uses a fronting company to issue those policies in Minnesota, and this will allow the state to capture some operational efficiencies and provide a little bit better transparency to the policyholders about who's actually insuring them. If this is adopted, we'll become the 18th state in the country to operate our auto plan in the same way. The goal there is, and the primary benefit is really the long-term stability of the plan. There's no operational concerns presently, but this is something that other states have found to be a more efficient and more transparent process. So with that, Mr. Chair, happy to answer any questions about any of the provisions, and thank you very much for moving the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. Is there anyone present who would like to speak to the matter before the committee, which is House File 2389, as amended? Anyone wishing to speak from the public on House File 2389 as amended? Seeing none, hearing none, Mr. Brickwitty, we do have a question from Representative Davids. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Brickwitty, good to see you. I'm on page 3.20, section 4. We talk about a limited long-term care insurance policy. How is that different than from a long-term care policy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, thank you. I think this policy will allow... Mr. Chair, this change is going to allow companies to sell long-term care policies that have a shorter coverage time period than a traditional long-term care policy and will have a modified benefit set as well. I think the benefit here is that, or the hope, based on experience in other states, is that these products would be less expensive than traditional long-term care policies and would provide another option for consumers. They're not currently written, I believe, in the state of Minnesota, but this would allow their sale. And as we try to buttress and strengthen our long-term care market for consumers, this is something that we hope will provide another set of options for policyholders and consumers to be able to take care of their long-term care needs.
Representative Davis, follow up.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Brickwood, I do have a quick question for you on that. When we talk about limiting the time period, I understand that typically they're written for a five-year period of time on a long-term care policy. And in order to be eligible, you have to have impairment on two of the six daily functions or activities of living. Can you talk about how those limitations may be? Is it going to be some of those daily functions or daily activities going to be taken out of the policy? Or how is that going to end up working when we talk about the modifications to coverage?
Mr. Chair, I may need to phone a friend on that question, as I've not personally worked on this in great detail. I think my understanding is that they would generally operate the same way, but there would be changes in the benefit set. So, Mr. Chair, I may need to follow up with you on that question directly if one of my colleagues is not able to answer it from the
And to that same side. Point, Mr. Brickwood, there's also sold with a daily benefit. You know, $150, $200 a day, whatever the case may be. Is that perhaps where the limitations coming in as far as that's concerned? Again, maybe you don't have that answer, but it would be a benefit, I think, to the committee to know what's happening on there. I've been in other committees where the long-term care policies have come up, and members have been had some concerns about long-term care policies. And if this is going to be making its way through, I think members should know what the department's contemplating in some of these changes, so that if this bill gets in front of some of those members who had concerns before, or in front of that committee again, that there are transparent answers on what's going on here. Lots of pages that talk about long-term care.
Mr. Chair, yes, we will follow up directly with you on that and for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwood. Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'm going to just piggyback on the long-term care, just to say that I would really appreciate something that clearly laid out what does this product look like, because I hear so many concerns from people who think they know what they're getting with their long-term care, and I'm really want to make sure that we don't set them up to think they're buying something that they're not. So that would be really helpful. But my question was about data calls. And what I'm interested in knowing is this a new way of requesting data? Is it an expanded way? Is it something that we're clarifying? Is it all of the above? I don't really understand the intent and the process here. Thank you.
Mr. Brickwood, to Representative Breyer's question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we are not expanding the department's authority to ask for new or different information. The proposal clarifies how the data that we receive in a particular project scenario is classified and how we hold it. So I'll give you an example. So the department has issued two major data calls in the last, call it 14 or 15 years. One was following the tornado that went through North Minneapolis in I think 2011. And then we did a longer-term data call project with the industry in the wake of the civil unrest in 2020. We were able to post summary information on our website and provide that information to legislators and policymakers at a higher level. After we made some changes to the department's authority to collect information in the market conduct exam process, which is our sort of most expansive, most intrusive to business operations method of gathering information about a company's business practice, we found in the course of the conversation on a new project this fall with the insurance industry that there was some concern on the part of some companies that there was no sort of middle point between data that was collected either using that market conduct authority or data that is submitted to the department and classified using the trade secret designation under Chapter 13. And the way that our trade secret designation law works in Minnesota leaves the department as the final decision maker about whether or not something is or is not trade secret, which was of some concern to companies and was seemingly sort of inhibiting their ability to participate in what we were hoping would be a voluntary project that we're working on presently. And so what we're trying to do is just clarify that when we're doing a very specific project, like the two examples that I showed you, or just mentioned to you, that's something entirely different from a market conduct examination. And it's also something that where we want that information to not be on a company-specific basis publicly brought forward. So we're not expanding the department's authority to ask for new or different information. We're simply clarifying that in the case of a data call, that's what we're calling that kind of specific targeted project, that this information would be held, it would be, as it is today, non-public, and we can provide summary information to the public, like we have in those previous examples, after we've provided notice to the companies that we're planning to do so.
Representative Breyer, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One follow-up. So I'm just imagining a situation where from the results of the data call, you have concerns and you look to going to a market conduct process. Is the data that you've requested in the data call available for that? Is it then no longer available to use for that? How do those connect if things were to progress? Thank you.
Mr. Bricklady, very interesting question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is a very interesting question. I think if the department were to be looking at a company's business practices in a market conduct setting or in sort of an enforcement capacity, that would be kind of an inherently different activity than what we are defining here in this space as a data call. So I think broadly the bill before you does not address that question directly, but I think our intent is that they would be totally separate activities. I think in the current example, the project that we've been working on with the insurance industry presently, what we're attempting to do is gather information about how companies are thinking about a statutorily required discount that they're supposed to offer to companies so that we can be more efficient in our regulatory practice when filings come in so that we have a better understanding from our actuary or for our actuarial team of like how are companies thinking about this broadly across the entire spectrum of the industry. And we can better understand that, you know, if there's a range and a filing comes in that range, it's something that we would expect. If it's outside of that range, that's something that we might want to dive in a little bit more. But that's a regulatory function as opposed to an enforcement function, which market conduct is kind of looking at how are the systemic practices of a business operating and how is that working for Minnesotans. So I think we would sort of see them as separate topics, but I think the direct answer to your question is that we don't really address that in this bill.
Thank you, Representative Breyer. We are now, the next question is from Representative Cha, followed by Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Chair. This is pertaining to Section 5 of the Minnesota Automobile Insurance Plan. Can you tell me how large or small this these coverage are in terms of, you know, volume?
Mr. Bricklady.
Mr. Chair, Representative, not off the top of my head. We could certainly follow up with you on that. The auto plan is the state's insurer of last resort, so the coverage amounts are certainly designed to not be a place where a consumer stays in the long term. In order to get into that market, typically a consumer needs to have been denied coverage or not be able to obtain coverage in the regular market. I think that's part of the advantage of the proposal from the auto plan in that once it is operational, the consumer will have an insurance card that says APSO on it, you'll know directly as opposed to having an insurance card from one of the fronting companies. But I don't know currently how many policyholders they have, but I could probably find it quickly with my computer once I get back to my chair and follow up with you, Representative.
Representative Cha.
And then just can you just give us some examples of like people that would qualify or, you know, I mean, have, are high risk. Can you give us some examples, please?
Mr. Bergwitty.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think, you know, similar to the conversation that we were having last week about the insurers of last resort on the property side, typically you're going to have consumers insured in the auto plan who either are for whatever reason not able to obtain insurance in the traditional market. They've either had denials because of an accident history or other sorts of things on their record. I think I wouldn't want to speak for the insurance companies on sort of exactly how they operate their business practices. My sense is broadly that it is a smaller insurer of last resort by volume compared to some of our other insurers of last resort, like the Fair Plan, which has the responsibility for insuring property. But it's going to be consumers who have had difficulty obtaining insurance in the private market. So I don't have the demographic breakdown or sort of income level breakdown. I think there is a bit of a spectrum there, but again, I can follow up with you directly. I just don't have them in my materials here.
Representative Chaw.
Thank you, Chair. No further questions.
All right, Representative Van Binsbergen, followed by Representative Elkins. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is in regards to, you know, as I meet with constituents, long-term care is a big issue for a lot of folks. It's confusing. I'm curious, do you have a lot of collaboration with the insurance companies out there in regards to clarity for people? And I'm also wondering, how many companies are writing long-term care in Minnesota?
Mr. Bergwitty.
Mr. Chair, Representative, to your second question, I don't know the exact number off the top of your head. Again, I will follow up with you on that. I think the long-term care industry, as you and other members know, has been challenging, not just in Minnesota, but across the country. I think we have done a couple of things to attempt to provide more options over the last couple of sessions to consumers about what types of products are available in the market, and also options for companies to try to write in this state. I think we have been fortunate in Minnesota that we have not had the same kind of volume of policyholders exposed to some of the larger insolvencies that have happened in the long-term care market that have affected other states more greatly. And I think we also are very fortunate to have on our staff some of the nation's leading long-term care experts on the actuarial side who've also been working very closely with state regulators across the country to provide a sort of regulatory and financial framework for long-term care companies to remain viable. I think one of the most important things that we've done in the last sort of 10 years or so has been to provide options for consumers to be sort of find soft landing spots if they no longer want to continue with the premium increases. And that has proven to be, while not necessarily a great option, it has been a better option for consumers and at least explainable option for consumers to be able to make a choice about, well, you know, I've been paying a premium for X number of years. I'm looking at the prospect of significant rate increases because the company, you know, for whatever reason, has needed to raise premiums to be able to continue to pay future claims. But you're able to exit that product by being made whole financially or without any sort of penalty. I think this is one of the products that we probably get the most calls about in our office, and I suspect that's true of legislators. I think we regularly are in contact with both caucuses, constituent services, offices. And I think some of those steps that the legislature has taken and that we have taken from a regulatory standpoint over the last couple of years have at least allowed us to have conversations with consumers about what their options are. But I don't want to try to really sugarcoat this particular market. It is one that has been very challenged and continues to be challenging in a time where we have more Minnesotans who need this type of coverage and this type of care moving forward.
Representative Van Binsbergen, follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, my
comment would just be, you know, I think it's important for the department to work closely with the insurance companies to develop policies and ideas that one are somewhat going to be containing in cost, because, you know, I've got lots of constituents that this is a real issue for. These premiums just continue to rise for them. And, you know, in one of the last question I had is under the limited long-term care insurance, it says that, you know, you're not going to be able to cancel, that they can't, an insurance company cannot cancel a policyholder for physical health under subsection 5.
Representative Binsberg, could you just cite the lines on the on there? It's just a little easier for folks to...
6.17, on page 6. Can you just explain that to me?
Mr. Berkowitz, do you have the location that he was referring to?
My concern is that... Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, I found the spot in the bill that you're looking at, Representative, but I'm not sure if I heard your question. So my apologies. Would you repeat it?
Well, you know, I'm just concerned about overall cost. And, I mean, can you... So an insurance company can they currently cancel somebody for physical health in the middle of a policy, or am I missing something there?
Mr. Chair, Representative, is your question could a long-term care, like on a traditional long-term care policy, is that what you're asking? This is a different product.
Okay. I realize that.
And so I think the attempt here is to craft something that would address the concerns that you mentioned a moment ago about cost by offering a more limited option or benefit option set. I don't know the answer to your question off the top of my head. Again, I don't work directly in long-term care, so my apologies for being somewhat limited in my ability to respond to questions in real time. But I think the provision here, and my apologies, I didn't directly answer your first question. This is a proposal that we have worked closely on with the industry, not just here in Minnesota, but also as it went through the National Association of Insurance Commissioners model law process. That's a process by which all of the state insurance regulators work and provide exposure drafts on proposals that can be responded to by industry, and this has moved through that process. We're not the first state to bring this forward. I don't believe long-term care companies are currently writing this type of product in Minnesota, but our hope is that they may be able to after this bill is passed.
Thank you.
Just a couple of things, Mr. Brickwood and Representative Van Binsberg. And one of when long-term care first came out, it was written with a guaranteed premium, so the premium couldn't go up. And that is one of the things that is providing pressure in the marketplace. Number two, the cost, when Mr. Brickwood said for whatever reasons the premium costs are going up, it's because the cost of delivering health care and support to persons who have ailing health and things are just going up. The cost is just is a known fact of where we are at. The other thing that's concerning to me about driving the premiums, since that's what we're talking about on here, would be other taxes or fees that would be assessed against these policies, which is being contemplated in the governor's proposal, again, just for the committee's benefit, that these policies would also be taxed. And again, we're just talking about some of the pressures that are on these policies right now. Adding additional premium tax on here is only going to add to the problem and the weight in these particular policies. And to Representative Van Binsberg, and to your question about cancellation of policies, there is an underwriting criteria, but most of these policies, just like other health insurance policies, don't have a cancellation provision, that if you need to use the policy, that we're going to cancel the policy. That's why you have insurance. So they'll screen for adverse selection. People who have pre-existing conditions and things that may be predisposed or already have symptoms, and I think that Representative Elkins has referred to that not only today but in other comments in the committee. So those would be the general criteria for an insurance underwriting process and a cancellation. With that, speaking for Representative Elkins, you have the next question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got two questions. One on this topic. I'm wondering if the department is aware of insurers that are actually interested in offering these types of limited policies.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know of any specific companies, but we have had those discussions with the insurance trade. So our hope is that after or if this law were to pass, that they would take a serious look at offering them in our state.
Okay.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the going back to the data calls provision, I've got a kind of a hypothetical for you, but we're looking at creating a task force to look at the cost of property damage coverage for multifamily housing. And is a data call an option that you might have to help an LCC-type committee like that pull together the data it might need in its deliberations?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I think it would. It would also allow us, I think, more efficiently to be able to provide summary information to policyholders on a variety of topics. But yes, I think it would.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no other member questions and no testimony from the public on the matter, Representative Finke, we will give you the final word before we lay the bill over.
Thank you, members, for the conversation. Thank you to the department for your expertise, and I move the bill.
Okay. I said layover because that's what we're doing with most of it, with the exception of your bill, which is going to be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. So with that, I will make the motion that House File 2389, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails, and your bill is on its way, Representative Finke. On our final bill this morning, and this one will be a layover, again, as we're trying to build a commerce policy bill here in committee this session, is by Co-Chair Herr, and it's House File 2398. And as Representative Co-Chair Herr is making her way to the testifying table, we'll give her a chance to settle in, and if you want to move that before the committee for layover, whenever you're ready, Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move House File 2398 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
All right, and I have no amendments. Is that correct, Representative Herr?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, then proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is a technical bill. There are a number of pieces to this bill that sort of span from updating student loan borrow bills of Bill of Rights to the Department of Admin's role in external review of adverse determinations. There's also a couple of few minor changes, and I can walk through each section. I don't know if you would like for me to do that, or would you like Mr. Smith to just talk generally to the bill, and we can just move to questions. Mr. Chair, it's up to you.
Chair Herr, it's your bill. If you want to make some comments and then turn over to Mr. Smith, or you want to do it in reverse, it's however you want to present it to the committee, whichever you think is best.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. And I know that oftentimes these technical bills do not are non-controversial, and there are not issues with it. And so what I will do is just, you all have the summary of each of the different sections in your folders. I will turn it over to Mr. Smith to make some comments about the bill, and then we can just take questions.
Very good. Thank you, Co-Chair Herr. Mr. Smith, how long has it been since you've been before the committee? About 15 minutes? We hope your health is better. Mr. Smith.
Chair Driscoll, I am obviously much better.
We were concerned.
Yeah, members of the committee, my name is Sam Smith. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Commerce. Happy to answer any questions about this bill, which will allow us to ensure that the laws we enforce and manage are up-to-date, accurate, and streamlined. Happy to answer any questions, but or to walk through the bill if that's useful.
Mr. Smith, Representative Herr referenced the fact that there's some written summary. That's great for members of the committee. But for those who are here publicly or those who might be tuning in to hear what's going on, is there a way that you could provide some oversight as to what's contained in the various sections of the bill and the topic areas since the public may be affected by the outcome of this bill? Mr. Smith?
Mr. Chair, I will take that as okay. Mr. Smith is having is recovering from getting better. I'll do more of the talking. So we can just go over a little bit section
Co-Chair
by section.
Herr?
If we all look at section one, is really just licensing and technology changes. I'm going to pull up my notes here really quick here, too. It's just licensing and technology fee changes. There should be nothing that is controversial or around this particular section. The second section is exemptions and exceptions and exemptions. It's just some cross-reference changes. Section 3 is transfer of accounts. Financial institutions are allowed to, Mr. Smith and I actually talked about this this section a little bit because they are having issues with, as we've all talked about, unclaimed properties, and sometimes these safety deposits end up there. And so it's just a really, Section 3 is actually about closing accounts if there are disruptive or hostile or harassing behavior from someone to, you know, an account owner to employees or customers, and it allows them with notice to just be able to close those accounts. Section 4 is this maintenance of permissible investments. It's just cross-reference corrections. Section 5 is the safety deposit. This is the one about how certain properties end up in unclaimed properties. And so Mr. Smith and I talked about this at a little bit of length, that it allows safety deposit leases to renew automatically at the end of the lease's term. And then Section 4 is just cross-references for lenders. Section 7 is around contracts and removes references to the Commissioner of Administration being a part of this process, and then also changes the process from having three organizations to just having more than one organization to be a part of this external review from adverse determinations. And then Section 8 is just, again, technical. It's about references to the North American Securities Administration Association and the Commission of Commerce. And then Section 9 gives the commissioner a little bit more leeway in allowing the use of an expedited rulemaking process that is already in statute and is allowed by the administration. And this just allows for when, I thought this was very important, and it just allows that, because the department oversees broker-dealer conduct and allows them to use the state agency's expedited process. So that's pretty much each of the section. I went through that pretty fast, but if anybody has any questions. And Mr. Smith, did you have anything to add to what I went over?
Chair O'Driscoll, members of the committee, another key element with the safety deposit box change is that it clarifies that the interactions with the safety deposit boxes with legislation in the past last session around the automatic renewal of subscriptions, and ensures that this law is kind of remaining under the banking statute. I know that there are folks from NBA, if folks have additional questions.
Okay, thank you. Co-Chair Herr and Mr. Smith, we have a question right now. Representative Katiza-Watoon. Chair Katiza-Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Smith, you kind of added a little bit onto the safety deposit box section, which is I had a question on, and then I have one other short question, Mr. Chair. But in that section regarding the renewal, automatic renewal of safety deposit boxes, is there any requirement that someone be notified that they have an existing safety deposit box and that it will renew?
Mr. Smith.
Chair Driscoll, Representative Katiza-Watoon, thank you for the question. You know, it's my understanding that this law is kind of trying to create some conformity issues, but I know there are some folks from MBA that could probably have a more precise answer to that question than what I can provide.
Representative Katiza-Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hopefully we'll be able to follow up offline on that. That would be helpful. And then in Section 7, the contracting section, it looks like it's removing a requirement to contract with an external organization for reviews of adverse determinations and reducing the numbers from three organizations to just one. Do you feel that this reduces the integrity of this review?
Mr. Smith.
Chair Driscoll, Representative Katiza-Watoon, thank you for the question. And no, there are two elements to that portion. The first is removing the Department of Admin from kind of this contracting process, which adds an we believe is an unnecessary bureaucratic layer. And then regarding the contracting process, this is still a kind of vetted, independent, external reviewer. And we think that as few as one provides a little bit more flexibility, but still ensures that consumers are being protected.
Representative Katiza-Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the whole, I support simplification. So if we're sure that this is not going to reduce that integrity and the efficacy of this process, then I think that is a step in the right direction. Thank you.
Mr. Smith, before I go to our next question, I want to follow up on something that Chair Katiza-Watoon mentioned with the safety deposit boxes about people being notified. Does that also follow under the forfeiture law of when we can't find an owner that Commerce takes custody of that? And I'm just dying to know how you get into the contents, because we're all told you got to have keys and the whole process about how to be able to get into that. It that just occurred to me when Chair Katizawatun mentioned that. Maybe you have some insight, maybe you don't, just out of curiosity. Mr. Smith?
Chair Driscoll, I look forward to being able to visit the basement of our building to see the safety deposit boxes after the session, but yes, we are one way that one recipient of these deposit boxes, and do whatever we can to ensure that folks have access to their property and can recover the safety deposit boxes if at all possible.
Very good. Our next question comes from Representative Elkins, followed by Representative Dotseth. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I like the idea of the leases, safety deposit box leases, renewing automatically, and we may have, might be that nobody can answer this question, but how does would a bank be notified, or is there a process in place that where, like the death master, Social Security death master, is checked on an annual basis just to see if that person is still alive?
Mr. Smith.
Chair Driscoll, Representative Elkins, thank you for the question. If a safety deposit box is no longer claimed, it would go to our unclaimed property.
Yeah,
Representative Elkins.
If we're automatically renewing the leases, there could be a safety deposit box which has contents, and the lease is renewed year after year after year. It may be that the box lessee has passed away. How does the bank know that?
Mr. Smith.
Chair Driscoll, Representative Elkins, apologies for misunderstanding your question. I think I'll have to get back to you on that, but I think it's worth considering in greater detail.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative and Co-Chair Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Elkins, I actually had that question of the financial institutions that have been in to see me as well about how they participate in the process to reduce unclaimed properties. And they did not have a sufficient answer for me there as well. So I think that this is something maybe we could potentially just explore a little bit more on our end to understand. They did say, they did tell me that when a property has been sitting unclaimed for, they do make attempts to try to reach out, but let's say if somebody's moved because they passed away and nobody lives there anymore, that they get stuck in this cycle of like there's nothing that they can do to actually reach anybody to confirm that. And so I think there could be a little bit more work that we as a Commerce Department could do to make a Commerce a Committee to do to assist with that as well. But it's a good question, and I appreciate you bringing that up.
Thank you.
All right. Our next question comes from Representative Dotseth. Representative Dotseth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for your testifier. I noticed that there's language in there that the institution can cancel policies for disruptive, hostile, and harassing behavior. How do you determine that? What's the procedure that they actually look at that?
Mr. Smith.
Chair O'Driscoll, Representative Dotseth. Thank you for the question. This language also came to us from MBA, I believe, but the standards laid out in place are kind of specific and defined in law, and if someone truly is disruptive, the bank has an opportunity to terminate that relationship.
Representative Dotseth.
So could they, if they didn't agree with their political standings or something else, could they actually determine that they could cancel their policy?
Mr. Smith.
Chair Driscoll, Representative Dotseth, I suspect that attempting to use this law in the situation you described would likely be a challenging case to make, and the individual would be open to litigation to oppose that decision by the bank.
If we are interested members, we do have representatives from the banking industry who do offer safety deposit boxes, and they can certainly speak to the current regulation. And so if that's the case, which I think we spent 10 minutes talking about this particular topic, maybe Tess Miller is interested in coming from the Bankers Association to talk about the matter. If you'll identify yourself for the record and clear up the confusion the committee has.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Tess Rice. I'm general counsel for the Minnesota Bankers Association. Representative Elkins' question about a lease continuing. So you're going to get a notice every year because you're going to be paying that safety deposit box rental every year, right? So if that doesn't get paid, it's going to enter into at that escheatment phase where they're going to wait. They're going to notify that you're not paying. You better come in and clean this box out, or it's going to eventually escheat to the state. And that's done with in the presence of a notary. All the contents are put into an envelope, and then that eventually is sent to the state, to their basement, where they hold it.
Thank you. Are there any other clarifications you want to make on the discussion this morning?
How about the harassing behavior here? If who determines what's disruptive hostile harassing, so that you can close the account? Do you have any thoughts on that?
So the language about closing an account, that is a common experience that our banks have of customers that are disruptive. They're stalking tellers and they're yelling at employees or other customers. This isn't a rare occurrence to the point where we suggested this language, but I think it's exactly as Mr. Smith said, that if a customer feels like they've been unfairly, their account's been closed unfairly, that this would be a matter of litigation against the bank. So it's not something they're going to take lightly. They're very risk-averse people in general.
Co-Chair Herr?
Mr. Chair, can I maybe ask nonpartisan staff, because I know that when I said in judiciary terms like pervasive and persistent and for harassing, those things were defined. I don't know if maybe if it's specifically defined in this part of it, and that I you know, maybe because I can see where Representative Dotseth is coming from, that if there needs to be more definition around some of this or maybe more clarity, that might be something that we could maybe explore. But if maybe nonpartisan staff could weigh in, if this is similar like we would see in, under the laws that statutes that govern judiciary.
Sure, great idea, Co-Chair Herr. Ms. Bonfoot, any insight for the committee?
Chair and members, I don't know that there are definitions of those specific words in that chapter of law, and it's not referencing crimes mm-hmm. specifically. It's just referencing human behavior. So they don't have to be charged with the crime of harassment in order for this to apply.
Co-Chair Herr?
Thank you.
All right. Other member questions this morning on the matter before the committee, 2398. Again, anyone from the public wishing to testify on 2398, just to make sure we've got that covered. Anyone from the public wishing to testify on House File 2398, which is before the committee, and its future is to be laid over for possible inclusion in a policy bill being contemplated by this committee. Representative Herr, seeing no other business, we will give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to have this heard today, and I ask for the committee support. Thank you.
With that, we'll lay the bill over, and Co-Chair Herr, I'm going to ask you to stay there because I have another question for you. Did you want to highlight for the committee the events for tomorrow when you will be chairing the committee?
Mr. Chair, I would love to do that, but I don't have my notes in front of me. So can I come back over there and take a look at my notes to provide
Absolutely.
Them?
I was Thank just looking you. For efficiencies of time is all. Co-Chair Herr, when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so tomorrow we will have some bills that we will be hearing. We will be we have some consumer protection bills and just social media, a couple of topics around, I think usually we try to do consistency in like a type of bills we're hearing. But on Thursday, we'll be hearing a consumer protection from Representative Lee, a NISCA bill, which is just a technical bill, and then a Finke bill around entertainment and potable water, and then a task force on homeownership, and then a Representative Stevenson social media bill. So that's sort of the slate for Thursday, and look forward to having them all ready to present.
All right. And with that, members, no other business before the committee. We are adjourned.